Jonathan has had a really varied writing career in his young life. His first major work was a memoir, Take Me Home. He's published as a poet, as a short story writer. Last year, he published the enormously moving and entertaining Entertaining Strangers. I believe it's in the bookshop. I heartily recommend it to you. Jonathan's also going to be reading, I think, from his short fiction inspired by music, Contact. Jonathan has also, for his sins, published as an academic two excellent works on 19th century literature. This afternoon, please join me in giving a huge hub welcome to Jonathan Taylor.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much all for coming. As Andrew says, I've just had a book of short stories published called Contact, and all of the stories in it are about different types and different pieces of music. The name of the sort of title story, Contact, isn't spelt C-O-N-T-A-C-T. It's spelt in a German way, K-O-N-T-A-K-T-E, pronounced exactly the same way. But Contact with a K is the name of a piece by an avant-garde composer called Karlheinz Stockhausen, who... You are the first person ever when I've read this out. Yes, good. Well, I'm glad that, because I've read this story about 100 times and I've never had a member of the audience who knows what it is. But Karlheinz Stockhausen's Contact is a piece of avant-garde electronic music. And you'll kind of get a feel, hopefully, for what the music sounds like from the story. But suffice it to say... I think it's fair to say it's difficult music. Yes. Right. So this is Contact. Derek came in from the cold and sat on the bed. Derek got up from the bed and went to make a coffee. Derek gave up making a coffee and sat back down on the bed. The kettle boiled unregarded. Derek sat in the dark. Derek got up again and stepped over to the stereo. He pressed play on the tape recorder. He sat back on the bed. In the dark, on the bed, Derek was surrounded by Karlheinz Stockhausen's electronic music. There were pings, crunches, and strangely comic doings. One of the neighbours may or may not have banged on the wall to tell Derek to shut his Stockhausen up. He couldn't be sure whether it was the neighbour or the tape. Derek sat in the dark on the bed. The kettle boiled dry and faded into the music. The tape ended. Derek was going to get up, but didn't. The tape automatically rewound itself and started again. Derek sat in the dark. The tape finished a second time, rewound itself and started again. Derek sat in the dark. After a few hours, things started to lunge out of the music at him. After a few hours, he thought he heard the dog from upstairs woofing amongst the white noise. After another hour, he thought he heard the ducks in Acton Park, Stockhausen ducks. Derek sat in the dark. There were whispers from hell. There were cars and lorries and a teleport in Star Trek and yesterday's indigestion. Then there was his mother's voice on the crackly line from Australia telling him to keep away from that bobble hat girl. Then there was his own voice telling that bobble hat girl to keep away from him, her asking why, and he arguing back, telling her it didn't matter how old he was, how old she was, how much he liked spotting her bobble hat from the Uxbridge Road, how far away his mother was, and so on and so forth. The fact was that feeding ducks together in Acton Park was no basis for a long-term relationship. Since his mother didn't approve of ducks, Acton, parks, bobble hats, the Uxbridge Road, and any combination thereof. "You're better off sticking to your tapes," said the crackly voice from down under, "than gallivanting round feeding ducks of all and sundry." Derek sat in the dark, sticking with his tapes. After another few hours, it was trying to get light outside the curtains. The music just sounded like white noise again. Derek got up from the bed. He had a bit of a headache. He walked over to the stereo. He pressed the stop button. The stop button was jammed. He pressed it again. It didn't budge. The tape rewound itself. Derek stood for a moment, wondering what to do, shifting his weight from one foot to the other. Stockhausen started again. Derek sighed and sat back down on the bed. Okay, I might as well, while I'm doing it, read you another very mini story, which again is inspired by music. And all you need to know for this story is what a lot of you already know, which is about the condition of synesthesia. Synesthesia, in short, is a condition whereby senses get mixed up. So the most common version of synesthesia is where people hear music as colours. And this story is called Synesthetic Schmidt. Since he had been a young man, Schmidt had listened in colours. Black was silence, brown was a Russian bass, blue was an Italian tenor, orange was his first Elizabeth Schwarzkopf concert, yellow was Herbert von Karajan's conducting, red was something else. For years, he'd told doctors and psychiatrists and neurologists that Bliss's Colour Symphony really was in glorious technicolour, that Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue was actually more of a magenta-mauve hybrid, and that Scriabin's Prometheus didn't need the light organ because it was already there in front of his eyes. Best of all, Bach's Art of Fugue was a counterpoint of rainbows. That's how it had been since the 40s, when he'd first heard the Art of Fugue arranged for a rather scratchy orchestra. Of course, none of the doctors had believed him. They'd been interested in other kinds of diagnoses and experiments back then. 50 years later, though, the medics and scientists were fascinated and wanted to put him through all sorts of neuroimaging tests. Was it genetic or advantageous synesthesia, they wondered? Was it caused by undetected temporal lobe epilepsy in his youth? Was it narrow band or broadband synesthesia, or a mixture of both? But it was too late for these questions, and Schmidt knew it. His glory days of hearing Mozart as refracted light were gone. One day, he'd woken up to hear a screaming, whistling sound in his left ear as a progressive tinnitus started dyeing the world red. "What are you hearing?" the GP asked. "Red," Schmidt said. "But how would you describe the sound?" the GP asked. "Red," he said. "But what kind of note is it?" "Red," he said. Everything was red. The GP, the GP's notes, the sky outside the GP's windows, everything. Everything was dyed red by a shrill C-sharp above the stave. "We can't find anything, Herr Schmidt, in our tests. There were no apparent causes, no ear infections, no foreign objects in the canal, no related nose allergies. You do not seem to have a low level of serotonin. You do not regularly take aspirin or quinidine, the sorts of things which might cause ringing in the ears. Without a cause, there is nothing we can do. Unless you can think of a cause, Herr Schmidt. But no, Herr Schmidt couldn't think of a cause. Schmidt couldn't think of a reason why he would spend his last few years in a red world, under a red sun, with a red wife, crying tears reddened by the never-ending dissonance of a C-sharp above the stave. He couldn't think of a reason for all this. He couldn't think of a time when, as a young man, he'd first heard the colour red. He couldn't think of a time when, as a young officer, he'd listened to a scratchy orchestra playing outside a huge factory. A factory in which he'd spent no more than a few days before being drafted elsewhere. A factory where he'd tried not to be part of anything, tried to keep his distance, tried, and for the most part, succeeded. Well, except for one minor incident, one long-forgotten moment, when a flautist from the orchestra had needed shooting, and had not been able to think of an excuse in time. And he'd heard her last C-sharp, and then seen the earth and air dyed red around her, and he couldn't, wouldn't think about it anymore. No, he couldn't think about that time when Strauss tasted of raining ash, when ash smelt of Lehar, when shoes felt like dead waltzes, when barbed wire looked like a Wagnerian prelude, and when symphonies were ash, shoes, barbed wire, tears, blood. I'll give you a choice. Do you want me to read some of the memoir, or I don't normally do this, but do you want me to read some of the memoir or some poetry?
Memoir.
Memoir. Okay. I might have predicted that response. Okay. So the memoir, which came out a few years ago, is about my father's illness and my experience of being a kind of part-time carer for him. My father, in his last years, suffered from Parkinson's disease and an associated form of dementia. And the book was always intended as not only a biography of my father and my relationship with him, and obviously myself, but also a kind of biography of an illness. As we all know, illnesses themselves have stories, have case studies. And it was, I suppose, in that way, a sort of an attempt to understand the process of my father's illness from the beginning to end. In the first chapter, which is called The Diagnosis, I tried to find what I thought was the origin or starting point for my father's Parkinson's disease, which is a very difficult thing because Parkinson's is one of these illnesses, like dementia, that can operate underground for a long time before it is recognised or diagnosed. So this chapter, which as I say is part of a memoir, is called A Diagnosis. There is a moment, sometime in distant 1981, when standing near the desk of a Saturday morning group called The Explorers, for talented chess-playing children like my elder brother and their tag-along siblings like myself, there is a moment which now makes my hair stand on the back of my neck, but which for years afterwards was just a Sunday dinner anecdote. A moment when my dad, at this point still working, still raven-haired, still capable of smiling, forgot my baby sister's name, like a paper shred gusted away. And with a laugh, and somewhere deep inside, a vertiginous panic, had to ask my sleeve and ask what it was. As ever, I didn't understand quickly enough. Didn't help. The memory may mean nothing except in retrospect, but I still feel that tug on my shirt as he lunged towards me. My mind just went blankety blank, he'd say. Was this the first inkling, my family wonders now? Was this the first one-way street his mind mistakenly turned up. But there were many other possible first inklings, some of them lost in the dead ends of my memory. A disease like his is so gradual, so much a continuum of grayness, one can properly remember only the most recent state, which now is death. All I can provide are fragments of memories, a list of vanishing points and partial origins. May 1983. I was nearly 10 years old. Apart from some nasty bullying, which persisted through my school years like the weather, I personally don't remember anything particularly startling about that spring. Even though my father was in the process of quitting his headmastership, having a nervous breakdown and contemplating serious self-harm. My mother had to ask my elder brother Robin to keep a careful eye on Dad whenever she went to the shops, in case razors, pills or kitchen knives were put to alternative use. My father had been prescribed amitriptyline, an antidepressant, on which he was dependent till 1989. He was also sent to regular sessions of a psychiatrist. I don't remember noticing any of these things. Perhaps it seemed that my mother put her hair in curlers more often at this time, a sure indication she was in a bad mood, but otherwise, nothing. It seems incredible to me now. How could a father's breakdown pass me by? Except that there was one thing. There was one afternoon, clambering up the stairs, my parents' bedroom door ajar in front, overhearing as I reached the top step, my dad on the phone saying that, "Yes, I've decided to change my mind and accept that early retirement offer you made," and then scampering back down the stairs, knowing that I've done something I shouldn't have, feeling that what I've done is wrong, but not able to tell a soul. A few weeks later, the second sign of my father's retirement visited my imagination. An electric tea's made, one of those 1980s quiz show prizes which made tea in bed for you when the alarm went off, appeared in the dining room. What a lavish leaving present for 13 years' service as headmaster of the toughest school in Stoke-on-Trent. 32 years' work as a teacher equals a tea's made, which also equals 10 minutes on a second-rate quiz show. This was a simple simultaneous mathematics equation, like the ones my dad used to help me with. To my frustration, the tea's made stayed in a box, despite my insensitive childish fascination, and eventually it merged with the attic dust. August 1987, I'm 14. Friends and my computer come round to play. My dad wanders in to ask if we want a cup of tea or anything, non-alcoholic of course, to drink. Then he shuffles off. Sometimes he comes back an hour later to ask if we want a cup of tea or anything to drink. Sometimes he doesn't come back at all. Sometimes he comes with the wrong things balanced precariously on an Isle of Man tea tray, biscuits swimming in what's been spilt. The first time my friends laugh and say to me, "You ask your dad for a cup of tea one day and you get an orange squash next week. The only thing slower than his tea making is his driving," I laugh too. The second time my friends laugh and say to me, "You ask for a cup of tea at your house and you get it next month," I laugh with them, swearing to myself I won't laugh next time, that I'll put up a fight. The third time my friends laugh and say to me, "You ask for a cup of tea and a jammy dodger at your house and your dad goes off and milks the fucking cow," I smile and stay quiet as he comes into the room, slightly lopsided, like a faulty tea's made. Spring 1988. My father's shakiness, stooped gait, spidery handwriting, slow driving, depression, nightmares, poor tea-making skills are all lumped together and diagnosed by a young neurologist looking for medals. "I know what you've got," he exclaims. No one else knows. No one else found it out. Just him. My father's condition is at the extreme end of a Parkinsonian spectrum, partly because it is early-onset Parkinson's. He's only 60 years old, and Parkinson's is usually an old person's disease, as if that makes it any better. No one told me about the diagnosis, of course. I thought Parkinson's was a law which stated that toast always falls buttered side down. In some ways, I still do, even though I realised I was mixing up Parkinson's and Murphy's Law. Family illness was never discussed in anything but the vaguest of terms in our house. I had an operation when I was 7 and found out what it was for when I was 17. I'd been out of anaesthetic for quite a long time. April 1988, a crisis. One evening, my mother says to me that I should stay upstairs because of a police officer with a picturesque, if rather paradoxical name of Sergeant Flowers is calling. As normal, I'm given the barest of details, but it seems that a van had been parked at the top of my parents' drive and that my father, reversing out, hadn't seen it and had hit it. Quite how he managed to do any damage, I can't think, given the speed he and the old Green Avenger generally agreed on. The man in a white van who'd been visiting our neighbours was furious to the point of wanting my imbecile father off the road, bollocked, thrown in jail, crucified and generally fucking dead. So Sergeant Flowers had had to intervene to berate my terrified dad further and threaten him with prosecution. My father never drove again. In this sense, Parkinson's was a disease of gradually giving things up. The Avenger was given up to my brother, driving to my mum. Only the terror of Flowers did he retain for himself. February 1991, a long-haired and washed teenager, known as myself, is sitting on one of the chairs of the living room, grabbing hold of the arms, believing that if he holds on tightly enough and stares at Cagney and Lacey, his mother won't notice that he's drunk 3.5 pints of cider at the local pub illegally. Mum is knitting in her green comfy chair as ever. Dad is asleep in his green comfy chair as ever. The teenager wonders why murders and scenes with incidental music never happened to Sharon Gless on Cagney and Lacey and never in his life, never in Stoke-on-Bloody-Trent. He wonders why he's condemned to live in a family where there is nothing but the straightforward, the mundane, the non-murderous, the amusical. No Sharon Gless needed here, thank you. There are no hidden skeletons, pasts, heroics, or even different chairs in this living room. There's only the gradual cardiganisation of parental ageing. Mum asks a question, and son answers, detaching each word from its neighbours in order to avoid telltale signs of slurring. Dad suddenly snores, alerting everyone he'll wake up if anyone interferes with a channel. Son turns his head and fails to focus on drooling father, seeing instead a magazine on the coffee table next to him. He stares at it for a moment, reading each separate word in the same way he's just spoken. The Parkinson, the magazine of the Parkinson's Disease Society. That was the first time my dad's twitches, shufflingness, and peculiar tempers were given a collective diagnosis. Instead of being sat down and told about it, instead of hearing what the name meant, what it would mean in future, I stumbled across it like some drunken idiot. But then, that's not dissimilar to how my parents found out about it. Parkinson's disease, a label which sounded important, serious. Something inevitably suggesting a piece of toast fallen buttered side down. Thank you. While we're on truth, rather than fiction, I might as well read you, I was only going to read you a small taster of the novel, really. Partly because it's maybe some of it's a bit unsuitable for a sort of afternoon audience with my niece and nephew here. I'll read you a small taster, and it's kind of from the afterword, which sort of sets out what was the germ of the novel. And actually, the germ of the novel was originally part of the memoir, but then I took it out and saved it for later for the novel. So the novel is a kind of fictionalized version of what was a real-life encounter. And the novel's epigraph, which kind of sums up the whole book, is a quotation from Hebrews, very famous quotation. "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware." hence the title, Entertaining Strangers. So this is from the afterword, and this is true. This is all a lot of the rest of the novel, obviously, is a fictionalized version of truth, but the starting point was this kind of memoiristic image. It's March 2001. Whilst my father is in intensive care in Stoke-on-Trent, I've had to come back to Loughborough for a few days to work. Late one night, I'm staggering home, drunk and bent forwards like a Parkinsonian, watching the pavement cracks under my feet, trying to avoid them like I did when I was a kid. I feel a pressure on my shoulder and hear a voice. The voice is saying, I'm homeless and I've not eaten in 36 hours. Do you have anything on you? Anything kebabish? I drawl, no. Then, yeah, I mean, no, I don't have anything here. But yeah, why not come back to ours and eat our freezer? As the voice and I walk together back to my house, I'm saying over and over, I hope you're not a thief or murderer or rapist or anything. I don't want you to kill me, please. I promise I won't kill you, says the voice, who doesn't seem offended at all. Back at my house, I drunkenly empty the freezer onto the grill. Sausages, bacon, chips, even pies. Yes, it is possible to grill pies. I ask the voice's name, and she tells me, Juliet, it's my favourite play. She doesn't look like the Royal Shakespeare Company's version of Juliet, with her shaved head and khaki jacket. Whilst Juliet watches the food burn, I drink vermouth by the pint. I ask her about herself. Why is she on the street? Where does she come from? Is it a story of a pair of star-crossed lovers and death-marked love? Loughborough's Juliet, though, won't answer these questions, except to tell me she's been homeless for a couple of weeks, having run away from someone, somewhere, for some why I'll never know. Instead, she prefers to talk about abstractions, domestic violence, debt, and my father. After Juliet's eaten all the pies, I ask if she wants anything else. She says a bath. I don't like smelling like this. After her bath, I tell her she should sleep in the house for a night. I offer her my bed. No, I couldn't possibly take your own bed from you. She thinks for a minute, unless we share it. I obviously look shocked, because she adds, I don't mean like that. I promised I wouldn't rape you, didn't I? Instead, I make her a bed on the floor. I hide my wallet under the pillow and feel guilty for doing so afterwards. Lights off, we settle down. She's already noticed the records in my room, and now she whispers, can we listen to something whilst we go to sleep? She searches through the LPs and CDs scattered everywhere and retrieves one. Can we hear this? She asks. It's a favourite of mine from long ago. I used to play it. I say yes, and snore off with a homeless woman called Juliet on my floor, crying to Elgar's strange piano miniature in Smyrna. Early next morning, with a vermouth hangover, I find Juliet in the kitchen eating burnt toast. My housemate, a chronic, depressive, dipsomaniac, insomniac anarchist, hard to say, is swigging the remains of a vermouth and reading out a chapter of his PhD to her. The chapter concerns the part played by ants in 1930s literature. Juliet seems quite content, listening and munching away. I whisper to my housemate, it's not what you think. He says, I wasn't thinking anything except about ants. He hasn't even noticed there's a different face in the house. He's just pleased there's a different receptacle for his ant meditations. And suddenly Juliet is gone. She says she hopes my father will be okay soon, thanks me for the pies and Elgar, kisses me on the cheek, and whispers that she believes in English gentlemen again. The door slams behind her, and I go back to my room to nurse my hangover and one of the best compliments I've ever received. I never saw her again, of course, but this book is at least partly for her. Thank you. And just in the last sort of 10 minutes or so, before we move on to questions, I'll just read you just a few poems. You sometimes get that, don't you? Here's some of me poetry. Oh, no. I'll just read a few of the poems from my book Musical Epsy, which is my first poetry collection. And again, a lot of the poems are about music in different ways, about music and cosmology, and sometimes about the interconnection of the two. So the first one I'll read, I wrote originally for an observatory called Chandra, which is run by NASA in America. And quite a few years ago, they issued a press release which had a sort of millions upon millions, tens of millions of hits, which is probably one of the most famous discoveries from NASA's Chandra Observatory, which is when they discovered that a black hole millions of light years away gave off a note, a particular note. And they worked out that this note that the black hole gave off was B flat, but a very, very low B flat. So this poem is called Black Hole in B flat. For 2.5 billion years, you've groaned B flat 57 octaves below middle C. For 2.5 billion years, you've moaned for no one because no one could hear you from the Perseus cluster 250 million light years away. Your galactic ground base, a million billion times lower than human hearing, dog hearing, even Keplerian hearing, who would have been hard pushed to retain an equal temperament in the face of such monotony, more monkish medieval drone than planetary polyphony. As if Palestrina never happened, and Bach dozed off at the organ shortly after the Big Bang, his elbow resting on a pedal point over which he dreamt his flickering fugues, short-lived as novas, short-lived as life, short-lived as anything but you, and all too soon sucked back down into your B-flat abyss. As well as writing about cosmology and music in the poetry, obviously the poetry kind of started where the memoir stopped. In that the memoir, there were lots of offcuts, you know, to the memoir, and lots of memories I wanted to encapsulate. But obviously, in a longer work, you're trying to kind of weave a long narrative together, and in effect, telling a story, even though that story's true. Whereas in poetry, you can capture sort of very small memories or very particular moments which somehow summarise longer stories. And so this poem is about a moment in 1982 when we used to go on, my father used to buy Rover tickets from British Rail, which were 14, they don't exist anymore, obviously, but they were 14-day tickets where you could have 14 days out. Incredibly exhausting, given that they had, my parents had four children. But they used to take us on 14 days out with this Rover ticket in a row. And we'd go to all the normal places around Stoke. So we'd go to Blackpool, that was our favourite. We might go to Morecambe, that was less of a favourite, but it was all right. And then gradually we'd work our way down. And by the end of the 14 days, we'd kind of got to the bottom of the list. And this is where I have to apologise to any members of the audience who are from New Brighton. This poem is about New Brighton. And I'll just explain one reference in the poem, which is to a photographer called Martin Parr, who produced a famous book of photographs of holidays, just about a bit before our time, but holidays in New Brighton. And they're beautiful photographs, but they're kind of honest photographs. And so afterwards he was banned from New Brighton, and the mayor gave various speeches castigating him. He's still deeply unpopular, I understand. So I'd probably also be unpopular for this poem. But this is called Sterile Promontory, July 1982. Ankle deep in New Brighton Beach, yellow cagoules greyed by drizzle, ears shrill sopranoed by the coloratura westerly, reminded, as if we needed reminding, coming from where we came from, that childhood is not one long summer, but one long preparation for something colder, greyer, drizzlier. Sinking into a mini spit of squelchy sand, corrugated, cobbled by northern waves, we worry round and round hundreds of white crabs. In limp lieu of Blackpool's arcade games or Southport's spiky grass wars, until their legs fall off, trying and failing to reanimate them with driftwood. But this beach is the opposite of a crustacean revelations, as salt puddle graves suck back their dead. While my crabby father keeps hearing in his head the last trump, which is the station tannoy announcing the last train. He's been as worried as the crabs about the train back since we got the train here. Looking at his watch in case we get too engrossed with crab corpses and miss the train, miss home, miss everything. We're here at the end of a 14-day Rover ticket, 14 days out, but we've run out of Blackpool's, Southport's, Holyhead's, even Morecambe's, and are reduced to this, a northern charlatan for something better we've never seen, which looks older than the older original, Martin Parr's last resort. But looking through his photos, I remember none of it. Not the ice cream drizzled faces, nor the fish and chip melee, nor the concrete sandcastles. And for me, New Brighton has shrunk to this crabby promontory of eroding sand mud memory surrounded by incoming tides and a miniature eddying dead. I'll read another poem, which is perhaps slightly lighter in tone, which is kind of self-explanatory from the title. And the title, which is very long, is Things Not to Talk About in Antenatal Classes, A Simple Guide for Fathers-to-Be. So this is Things Not to Talk About in Antenatal Classes. Caesareans, bleeding, bottle feeding, pain. Intensive care, depression, hypertension, prematurity. Because it's a synonym for pain, poetry. Religion, in case one couple is evangelical. Darwinism, and certainly not the fittest in survival. Cosmology, because everyone will think you're eccentric. Politics, global economics, sex, race, films, music. Everything else. If in doubt, sit behind your partner slightly, smiling redundantly, embarrassed mildly by what your sperm has done. Afterwards, take your partner by the hand, help her to the car, close doors, central lock, and chatter together like a pair of puppet socks about anything you want. Shall I do one more? Yeah. Okay. I'll do one more. This poem is called Cine Camera. And when we were young, when we were children, my father had a cine camera, Super 8. Cine camera, and on Sundays would nag him to project the films onto. He had a little projector, and it would nag him to project them. And gradually, the older we got, the more they started to burn out. So, Super 8 film is very delicate, And gradually, all of the film started to be consumed whenever we projected it by this blue flame in the middle of a projector. But actually, what we were interested in was not really watching the film. What we were interested in was when my father rewound the film. Because we always thought it was hilarious to watch things going backwards. You know, technology has moved on a lot since my childhood. But we always seemed to think that that was extremely funny, watching people sliding up slides and so on and so forth. So this is called cine camera. Cine camering backwards, that was what we demanded on those projected afternoons as forward history was consumed by a flickering bluish flame imposed on our childish games like some retrospective truth. But we craved comedy, not combustion. And it was always amusing to see slides and sliding, sandcastles and trampling, fathers' faces and lining, leavings and waving. And I thought the back spooling might undo forever if father were distracted from projector, forgetting the off switch before the first cartridge, re-embryoing the family, Super 8 dehistoried, then faster. Wars parting like seas, flattened empires arising like souffles, apes gladly unshackled from learning, dinosaurs slinking back to the sea, fish consumed by fires, and faster still, system stars sucking in cheeks with pop and crackle, tracing their way home in a boreolytic smile, 13.7 billion years long, where the film almost comes to a halt. What is left of the universe, coyly pin pirouetting in slow reverse, through its last million years and coalescing lakes of quark tears to the final 10 to the minus 6 of a second, slowing almost to the point of points, that pre-Planck moment when density, temperature were infinite and encased in prismatic rainbows were all laws, histories, camera frames, and we, supernovae, black holes, galaxies, slid slides, crushed sandcastles, merely the epiphenomenon of that first shattering, that blue flaming. I'll do one more, so because that's ending on a bit of a pessimistic note. Okay. This one. Quite short. This one's called Mozart's Clarinet Sextet. And for the musical amongst you, you'll recognise immediately that there is no such thing. Mozart didn't write any clarinet sextets. He only wrote a clarinet quintet. But this is in part about something that really happened to me again. When me and my wife, before the twins were born, and we actually went out. We went to a concert of Mozart's Clarinet Quintet in I think it was Loughborough Town Hall. All of Loughborough's bourgeoisie was gathered together, all six of them, and we sat down. And next to us, this woman sitting next to us was absolutely plastered, totally drunk. And in the second half of the concert, she started joining in, which we thought was hilarious, but a lot of other people didn't. So this is Mozart's Clarinet Sextet. On stage, Mozart, clarinet, four strings. Next to me, a sozzled hiss humming, counterpoint of gin, tears, and we. That's Beethoven's Ode to Joy, that is. No, it's not, shushed and shushing back. The hiss hum slumps forward on an ease. You and me, we're on a promise tonight to a row of husbands, all sober suddenly, whose postured wives seem transfixed by an allegro they can only half hear, willing a periwigged bouncer into being, conjured from their clenched handbags. Unbouncered and ignored, hiss hum sulks. You can all go fuck yourselves then. Back on chair, she's full of nods and nudges. I expect everyone's Ode to Joy, that is. No, it's not, someone shushes again. But I begin to dream it's she who's right. As a hiss-hum percolates to music, strange how concordantly her descant fits. Drunkenly travelling back and forth in time, entwining Mozart and a public desperation with joyful Beethoven. And you never know, maybe she's right about the husbands too. Thank you.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. We have a few minutes for questions now, if there are questions from the audience. Any hands going up at this stage?
Firstly, I'd like to say thanks ever so much. I came not knowing, and I'm not disappointed at all. I'd like you to tell us a little bit, if you would, about the first time when music really took you somewhere transcendent. I bought the Thunderbirds record when I was seven, but that wasn't a transcendent moment, it was later. So when was the first time when you knew that music was going to be a really important part of your life?
That is a really good question. I'm sure we've all got sort of we've all got kind of embarrassing musical memories back in prehistoric ages. So one of my first records was actually Barry Manilow, which is but I really liked him at the age of eight. But as regards a kind of first sort of transcendent moment, I think it probably didn't come till later, as with a lot of people. In your teens, adolescence, music is incredibly important to so many teenagers, and it was it was classical music. It's probably something like Tchaikovsky, it just sort of Tchaikovsky is good for adolescence, I think. I love it, still love it, but that kind of on your sleeve emotionalism, I really connected with, and I was the first writing that I did when I was a teenager was hugely kind of melodramatic in the kind of Tchaikovskyan style. So I think it was probably that. I remember going to concerts and just being sort of bowled over by the kind of sheer volume, really, the sheer sort of irresistible kind of sound of an orchestra. I think I'm not sure I could pinpoint an exact moment, but I could certainly say that round about the 13, 14 mark, music became something that actually I felt expressed emotions often better than literature in some ways. And there's that infinitely famous quote of all art aspires to condition of music, and in some ways I think that's true, that actually I'm a writer because I can't be a music, I'm not good enough to be a musician, tried, and what I'm always trying to do in my writing is something musical and is kind of reach that kind of emotional level that you do get in music instantly, that kind of visceral experience, which literature tries at and sometimes reaches. Okay, it kind of semi-answers your question, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's a great question. Any other questions at the stage? The smartest man at Greenbelt.
I don't know anything about you. I just wanted to ask you if in this year, the 200th birthday of Verdi and Wagner, if opera had any effect on you, because that's where music and literature do notably come together.
Absolutely. And
which ones you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And a number of the stories in the short story collection are about operas. And in some ways, writing about opera is easier. It's much easier than writing about absolute music, because you've got the instant kind of connection with the words. So you can use the words and so on and so forth. And this is my nephew, by the way. And so you have that kind of instant connection, instant ability to write about opera, which is much easier, I think. And so there are stories about Turandot, and I've written poems about Aida, and stories about Aida as well, actually. And I also kind of, opera obviously also has that, maybe is the place where literature reaches that kind of visceral level, which I'm kind of aiming at in some ways in my writing. But it's certainly the case where that it's easier to write about. For example, the Stockhausen piece, I wanted to write about it, but I found it very hard. And in the end, the main way that I found of simulating what is absolute music is just through the kind of rhythms of the prose. So trying to get the prose to actually sound in a kind of fragmentary way, like the piece. But obviously, opera is easier than that.
Very good. Any more questions, or do we perhaps thank Jonathan? Well, Barry Manilow writes the songs that the whole world sing. Jonathan writes books that the whole world should read.
I always end up confessing things I shouldn't.
No, it's okay. Yeah. I join you. Yeah, yeah. I still like Barry. I've got room in my heart for him. Anyway, please join me in thanking once again Jonathan Taylor.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you.